Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to another edition of Weekly Conservative Talk. Just Plain Bill with Weekly Conservative Talk. My partner in crime, Tracy Coyle, is wending her way to San Diego, on her way to a different kind of life. So let's get started. Let's talk about some things that are going on in the world. And you're going to get my take on it, not anybody else's. Let me give you a couple of data points, and then we will get into the meat of this thing. There is, in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the council was told, the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania Council was told that they should consider bankruptcy. This is Pennsylvania. This is the fifth largest population state in the country. And they are supposedly going to consider seeking client Chapter 9 bankruptcy protection. And that's what the city controller, Dan Miller, told a three-hour special committee hearing. Not everybody is in favor of that, but the whole part of that is they have guaranteed payments on $282 million in bonds on their incinerator, which is run by the Harrisburg Authority. That adds up to four times the amount the city collects in property taxes each year. That is not good. Nobody wants to do it, but Chapter 9 is there for a reason. And that reason is when cities extend themselves to the point that they can no longer cover their debts, then they need to be taking some action. The other thing, another data point, is Detroit. Now, Detroit has a reputation. Nobody wants to live in Detroit. They're talking about bulldozing parts of the city, all of those kinds of things. But how bad is it there in Detroit? Not one single person stepped forward to run for the Detroit School Board. Nobody. Nada, zilch, zip, zero. They are in a position where they no longer have anybody in that city, apparently, interested in running for a school board. What does that tell you about where folks are? What does that tell you about, gosh, what would happen if they had an election and nobody showed up? That's absolutely criminal. So here's my message to you. You start at the lowest level possible, whether that's a school board district, whether that is on a public utility district board, if you happen to not be an investor-owned utility city or county or state. You start at the lowest levels, and you bring your conservative principles to work with you. And you say, hey, I'm here, I'm willing to step up, but things have got to run right. Things cannot run as they have before. I mean, how often do we hear that today about our current politicians and the system that we have now? It isn't working. It doesn't work for you. It doesn't work for me. It doesn't work for the guy next door. The only way we cure that The only way we cure that is to step up and do the job. And you say, well, I've never run for anything before. Well, yeah, okay, so what? Are you halfway smart? Have you run a business before? Have you worked in a business in a decision-making capacity? Then get out there and do something about that. The political process is not for politicians. It's for us. We are the ones that have to. We must, if we're going to take our country back, we must get out there and talk about what we're going to do. And I'm telling you this, if we don't do that, then we've got nobody to blame but ourselves. Nobody to blame but ourselves. We have got to step up to the plate. We've got to bring our conservative principles to work with us. And then we've got to say, here's what we need to do. And if you come up with those ideas, people are going to flock to you. They're going to come to you and say, what ought to we do about this? What should we do about that? And if you stay true to your principles, I will guarantee you that you have an ability to affect that outcome. I'm going to bring a guy on now, called in. Some of you on Twitter will know him, Greg W. Howard. And this guy is really amazing. You should read in the Examiner, it's online, you should read his latest article, actually his very first article, Maiden Voyage. And let me tell you what, he came out with a bang. Greg is a financial planner, and he brings a lot of real-world stuff to us. So I'm going to bring him on now. Greg, how in the world are you?
I'm doing great, Bill. How are you?
I am fine, sir, and I thank you so much for calling in. Tonight's topic is kind of bubbles, and I know that you've done some work on that, and I've kind of jotted down, literally, people on the back of an envelope from the Trinity County Planning, 61 Airport Road, Weaverville, California, right here on the back of my envelope, and I'm counting stock bubbles, credit bubbles, consumer spending or lack thereof bubbles, real estate, both single-family residence and commercial, energy and food. Now, before we start on this, y'all ought to realize that we have what the government is telling us is a 9.5% unemployment rate. I just did today a pretty quick calculation, and I took 16 to 65 and what that population was, and I got a 22.57% unemployment rate. Folks, that is not acceptable. And yet, our government will, with a very straight face, tell us, oh yeah, you won, sure, it's only 9.5%. And by God, it could have been worse. It could have been 12, 13, 15%. That's what our illustrious president said just a few days ago. And that's just horsepucky. So, having said all that, you said today, Greg, that it would appear that our stock may be 40% overvalued. Is that accurate?
Yeah, and I'll tell you why. Since 1982 to 2007, stock prices rose 1,400%. At the same time, corporate earnings only rose 300% over the same period of time.
Hmm.
So just doing quick math on that, you see that the Dow, which was valued at about 1,000 starting in 1982, should be somewhere around 3,000 at this point if you allow for a 300% increase. But what you want to do, we also have to be fair and factor in inflation. And inflation during that same period of time was about 219%. So bring that 3,000 up two more times, and you're very close to 6,500. So that's about 40% of where we are right now.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, there is a whole host of people that depend on the value of the stock market. And folks, it's not just the big investors. I mean, yeah, they profit, I mean, because they know how to play that market both up and down. But when you talk about people that have stocks, mutual funds, in their 401ks, and whatever the equivalent is for government workers, that's a big hit.
It is, and remember, that's based on the price as of 2007, and that's when we had better corporate earnings. We had more. We were near full employment. We also had the real estate bubble just barely starting to unwind. We had much stronger economy, even though things were topping in October of 2007, than we have today. So it could be very well that the price of stocks will eventually travel below 6,500, but that's my initial target for this bear market, to take out the stock bubble that you mentioned earlier.
Hmm. So if we get down to the 6,500 level, that get us out of the woods?
No, because we're still unwinding all the other bubbles at the same time. All these bubbles have been basically interdependent and have grown over the same period of time, some coming on a little later, but they've all been feeding off each other. And so we have bubbles inflating other bubbles and supporting other bubbles. Like you said, we have the credit bubble. The credit bubble, of course, led to the consumer spending bubble. Of course, also that credit bubble is dependent on the real estate bubble, where house values went up ridiculously and people borrowed more than their houses are worth today. And then on top of that, you have the stock bubble, which gave everybody the wealth effect that Greenspan spoke about when he did pop the dot-com bubble in 2000.
Ah, irrational exuberance.
Yes, remember that famous term, irrational exuberance. He was correct, and bubbles are always accompanied by irrational exuberance. We
sure.
also have a couple. We have a couple other bubbles that you didn't mention. One
Uh-oh.
Of which is the gold bubble. Now that is years away from popping at this point. So, I would if people want to play the gold bubble, please feel free to do so. Understand that it's going to retrace and go forward, but. It'll be several years before the gold bubble actually pops. And then, of course, we have the U.S. dollar bubble and the government debt bubble, which is all built, of course, on a house of cards of this economy that seems to be able to borrow money in order to fund everyday operations of the government, not special operations as we did in the past with wars and so forth. We are now funding everyday functions of the government like Social Security, defense, Medicare, Department of Education, Energy, all these departments, with bubble money that's borrowed from other overseas investors. Now, look at China. Their economy is slowing rapidly. Why? Because our consumer spending bubble is starting to pop.
Mm-hmm.
Who is China's biggest customer? The United
yeah.
States. Well, if we're not buying, then China has less money to put into our bubble.
Wow. I read a report, I think it was about 2 days ago, that said that consumer spending had slowed by 0.5% in June. Now, when I went online to check that, the government figure is, no, it went up 0.5%. So I'm a little unclear as to how we got a 1-point swing there between what the government is saying and other reports that I've read. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't take the government numbers with anything more than a grain of salt. You mentioned very accurately that we have a reported U1 level, the unemployment U1 number, at 9.5%. That doesn't include all the people that have lost their unemployment benefits. Doesn't count the people who've given up.
Right.
It doesn't count the people, the engineers now flipping burgers to make sure family has something to eat. It does not count a lot of people who've simply moved off into the self-employment world and are really not making any money yet. So I've heard from Bob Chapman, international forecaster, very respected worldwide known economist, that he had the rate at 22.125%. So you come up with 22.5 on the back of an envelope,
yep.
And I think we're all on the same page.
Yeah, I think we are. You know, and if you if you accept the number that consumers are 70% of our economy, and I haven't seen anything or read anything that refutes that, that says, no, I'm sorry, that's just, that's the bogus number. So if I accept that the consumers are 70% of the economy, and I've got an actual 22.5 or 22.125 unemployment rate, that does not bode well for our consumer markets, does it?
No, and look at also that people are no longer able to piggy bank their houses through home equity loans.
Mm-hmm.
Look also that the stock market bubble is unwinding. Look at how mutual funds right now are hemorrhaging cash. The reason for that, of course, is you got 22.22 or 22.5% of the population that's not working, many of whom had regular payroll deductions into a 401k plan. So that money's no longer going into the 401ks. Many are in a position where they're upside down on their houses, or they had a $900 to $1,000 a week job, and they're all of a sudden having to live on $200, $250 a week, whatever unemployment may be in their particular state.
Mm-hmm.
So they're saying tax consequences be damned, and they're pulling the money out of the 401k simply to survive, or they're taking 401k loans or some other way to get the money. This causes mutual funds to have to redeem the cash, which means they have to sell out stock positions in the market in order to meet those cash calls.
Wow. Well, and you bring up the fact that the ATM of the home equity market is non-existent anymore.
No.
In addition to that, there's a report out of a Dr. Chris Salvino, he's running for Congress, that says that the retail vacancy rate, now this is commercial real estate, at least in Metro Phoenix, continued in the second quarter with 211 square feet of space added to a staggering inventory of vacant storefronts. And that pushed it up, the overall retail vacancy rate, to 12.2%. So if our real estate market is going down, and incidentally, the housing starts declined by 5% in June, down to an annualized number of 549,000 homes. The single-family residences fell 0.7%. The multifamily residences fell even further than that, and that's just in single-family residency housing starts.
Right.
Now, there was a slight pickup in permits, but I think we all know that permits, not all permits, get built, number one. And number two, if they can't get financing for them, and we're going to talk about that credit bubble here in a second, how in the world do they get them built? I mean, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Well, here's what's going on in that, Bill. These big developers are sitting on uncounted acres of land that they purchased during the bubble in order to build houses. Now, that land is doing nothing but acting as a cash drain on them right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if they sit on it, they're going to go bankrupt. So they have no choice but to try to build, as almost as an act of desperation, to try to recoup some of that money by selling the lots and the houses at some point in the future. So as a result, they may be heading themselves into bankruptcy that way. I was just reading Aftershock by Wiedemeyer, I believe his name is, and he predicts in that book, and he's a PhD, I believe he has his degree at Wisconsin, and which is very well known for their economics program, by the way, and he's predicting that the home builders, that none of the publicly traded home builders, you know, Toll Brothers, to name one for an example, is going to survive this.
Oh, my gosh. They were.
Now, that's a rather radical prediction, but, you know, he's pretty accurate in his description of how we got into this mess. I highly recommend the book. And I think you can get a free copy on Newsmax if you subscribe to a magazine or something, but I think you can also get it fairly cheaply at Amazon at this point.
Well, sure. Yeah, right. Well, that kind of goes into a report that I read, which was put out by Lender Processing Services, and they've got a report called the Mortgage Monitor Report, and the nation's foreclosure inventories reached record highs. Now, this is in February. February's foreclosure rate was 3.31%, which represented a 51% year-over-year increase. Now, a 3.31% foreclosure rate just in the month of February works out on an annualized basis. If everything else stays the same, all of the numbers come in right straight across the board there. That works out to a 39.7.72% annualized rate. And there are 7.9 million loans that are problem loans.
Right. I saw on Rasmussen the other day a poll where homeowners themselves admit 35% of them to being underwater on their mortgages.
35%. That's incredible.
And what, of course, that leads to is at some point people are going to say, you know what, I'm just not going to pay anymore. Now, this puts the banks in an interesting situation. We all know what happens to vacant property.
Oh, yeah.
At some point, these banks are going to decide that it'd be better to have squatters in the home than to forcefully evict all these people when they have really no reasonable prospect. As we see home prices slide further, they're going to simply start letting people, I think, stay in the home. Now, I wouldn't recommend that you simply stop paying your mortgage in the hope that you'll be allowed to be a squatter, but you're already seeing some of this in the commercial real estate market. The hardest thing on earth to insure is empty commercial property.
Yes.
As a result, many commercial landlords are simply allowing for maybe just utilities and costs like that for folks to stay in the office space, and some are just saying, hey, stay there so I don't have to pay three times as much in property insurance on top of everything else I'm losing.
Oh, man.
So it's a real mess, and bubbles don't unwind all at once. You know, the dot-com bubble unwound quickly, and the reason for that is very simple. Stock markets trade in the flash of an eye.
Yes.
And so it's very easy to unwind a huge stock market bubble like the tech bubble of 2000, which had the NASDAQ all the way up over 5,000. Now, if you don't think that the stock bubble can burst and come down very low, what happened to the NASDAQ after that? It lost 80% of its value, or 60 to 80% of its value within a year as that bubble unwound. Now, after all this time, 8, 9, 10 years later, we've managed to get all the way up to 2,000 on the NASDAQ.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not trying to scare people, but I want people to understand where they are. If you know where you are, there's no need to have fear anymore, and fear is based on not knowing what the situation is or not knowing what to do.
Absolutely.
To alleviate fear, know your situation, and then take appropriate rational action.
Yep.
So I'm not trying to scare folks. I'm trying to get them to understand where they are and some of the things they should consider doing at this point.
Well, and that kind of brings up an interesting thing, and I ran across this about a month ago, and it's obviously been going on longer than that, but that's when I ran across it, and that's the concept of a strategic default, wherein people purposefully decide to quit paying their mortgage. They say, I'm underwater. It isn't worth it anymore. I'm going to stay here until they kick me out.
And that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Exactly. And these are on single-family residences.
Right.
That's the same problem that the commercial real estate people run into. Although in a little bit different fashion, but if you stop and think that we had a 3.31% foreclosure rate in February, and that more than 1.1 million loans that were current at the beginning of January were already at least 30 days delinquent or in foreclosure by February 2010 month end, and that we have 7.9 million non-current first lien mortgages and real estate, other real estate owned properties at 7.9 million, all of a sudden we get up to 10 million properties really quickly, don't we?
Yeah, we do. I'm going to take your word for the math because I'm sitting at home. It's a little later out here in Alabama where I'm located, and so I don't really have a calculator. I'm kind of just running through the house to avoid the family noise that seems to want to be chasing me.
Yeah, but, yeah. Well, no, I'm pulling these numbers off of CNBC.
Okay.
And this was an article by Diana Olick, who is a CNBC real estate reporter, and the quotes that I gave of the 7.9 million in first lien mortgages that were non-current and REOs, and the 1.1 million loans that were current at the beginning of January were already at least 30 days delinquent or in foreclosure by February 2010 month end. Those all come from her article. So,
I would take that as accurate. There's certainly nothing there to the other than objective numbers that can easily be checked by a number of other reports.
Sure. Yeah. And I guess the thing that I'm saying is this, or at least it seems to me that here's the situation with the housing problem. We have a record number of people that are foreclosed on. We have a record number of people that are in default. Some portion of those are strategic defaults, people who have simply said, you know what, it takes 1 to 2 years for you to get me out of a house. I think I'm just going to quit paying my mortgage, and here I am, and 1 to 2 years from now you'll get me out. That means that effectively that 7.9 plus 1.1, which is almost 10 million, not quite, is no longer has real estate that they can pull any equity out of because they don't have any equity. They're done.
Right. And the house has been traditionally middle America's greatest store of value over the years, even before the bubble years. People bought a home, they paid on it for 30 years, the house went up at a reasonable rate, and by the time they were retiring, they were living in a home worth several times what they paid for it, and they owned it outright, and they could sell it usually within a reasonable amount of time if they needed the cash.
Hmm.
So now, the store of value towards retirement, you know, you have no idea how bad off seniors are right now. I deal with many of them every day.
Yep.
People are retiring with little or no savings whatsoever. They have really no value in their homes. And Social Security is precarious as anything I've seen in a long time. So it's really a sad situation for those on in the pre-retirement and in window and those already in retirement.
Hmm. Any sage words of advice for?
It's never too late to start.
yeah, that's true.
I mean,
it is never too late to start.
You may have missed the power curve of compounded interest over the years, but it's certainly never too late to start. And for Pete's sake, if you're still holding long in the stock market, don't just take my word for it. Get out and read some other works from other authors, financial planners. Don't listen to your Edward Jones guy. They're a fine company, but they make money if you stay invested in the market and trade actively with them.
Mm-hmm.
So please find non-broker financial advice from some source.
Yes.
And determine if you really want to sit there and watch this bubble unwind underneath your investments. Now, if you're in a 401k or an IRA where you have limited options, actually those in an IRA are a little bit better situation. They can go to cash. They can go to inverse ETFs. They have a lot of options. Those in a 401k find their options a little more limited by the basket of funds selected by their administrator or their trustee.
Hmm.
In those cases, I'm recommending you go for the most conservative or even cash or money market position if you can. So, but certainly you don't want to be sitting long stocks right now. And there's no sector in the world that's going to be safe. Now, there's going to be occasional imbalances where Europe might go up a little bit while the U.S. is going down, but it's all heading down together.
What about a bond portfolio, Greg? At some point in time, interest rates have to start going up. They can't. They can't stay where they are because they're effectively zero at this point. So if they have to start going up, wouldn't a strategy be to ladder your way up via short-term bond holdings?
Short-term bond holdings I could see, and I'll tell you what. Remember, a bond is what? It's debt. You're buying the debt of someone else, whether it's a corporation or municipality, a state, or the federal government. Or an overseas government. Okay.
Yep.
Okay, do any of those sound really particularly strong right now? You were talking about Title IX at the top of the show.
Oh, absolutely. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
First thing to do, if you're in municipal bonds, run.
Yes.
Corporate bonds, remember that as the bubble deflates, you may see some companies outperform in the bond market, but these are all denominated in U.S. dollars. The dollar bubble is going to burst at some point. Some people are putting it 18, 24 months out. I don't have an opinion on that because I am not that learned about macroeconomics, okay? You might want to, in a short term, you could. Now, there might be some other options. You know, you could look overseas. There are several countries that have sound monetary policy. The countries have natural resources, and they are starting to raise their interest rates to avoid inflation in their nations. And one of whom you might look at is Australia. Another would be Norway. Canada, our friend to the north, is in much better economic position than we are.
Absolutely, yeah.
So if you have that option, and you can get these as ETFs in your portfolio, you can certainly do that. And if you're a little bit more on the daring side, you can look at inverse ETFs on the S&P, the QQQ, or the NASDAQ, or the Dow, and play those inverse ETFs and maybe profit as the market unwinds.
Yeah. Well,
ProShares. Go ahead.
That's how the big guys do it. I mean, they follow the run-up, and they make money that way, and then they follow the run-down, and they make money that way. So, the big guys tend to do okay, regardless of which way the market is going. There's always an opportunity there because you can either do a reverse ETF or you can play the straight long position. There's variations on that. You can buy puts and calls and all that kind of stuff, and I know that you do that. But that kind of gets us to the credit bubble. And an interesting number that I came across just today is that we have $13 trillion in credit card debt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's an astounding number to me. $13 trillion in credit card debt. Did you know that in December of 2009, there was a 12.56% charge-off rate? And that comes directly from Fitch. This is not a pie-in-the-sky number. This is from Fitch, who really tracks that stuff. That works out to a $1.63 trillion charge-off just for that month.
Mm-hmm.
So
you can track this drop in consumer credit. It's dropping now. Those numbers were as of 2008. And it is dropping due to charge-offs, due to debt simply going bad, due to bankruptcies. And right now I saw a report today on moneynews.com that consumers are paying down their debt as fast as they can.
So, I have read that, yes.
Right. I think I tweeted it today, and a lot of people retweeted it, so it ended up all over the place.
Yep.
But in any event, there is, if you Google economic calendar, you can see a weekly or biweekly report available on the amount of consumer credit. I think it normally comes out on Tuesdays.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you can see the number dropping of how much consumer credit is dropping off. So people are trying to unwind themselves out of the consumer debt bubble, which is very good. It's easier to do, of course, with a credit card than it is with a house. But
yeah,
people are working very hard to get themselves out of debt. So I would recommend that folks, if they continue to do that, consider maybe take a little bit of that money that you're putting toward debt and hold back a little bit for savings.
Absolutely.
You're actually going to need the money in the long run. At some point, it may be that you say, credit card company, be darned, I'm going to feed my family. We're talking survival when we talk about these kind of nightmarish scenarios.
Oh, absolutely. And there are so many facets to that credit bubble. Another report that I read today had to do with student loans. Now, you think to yourself, yeah, okay, student loans, yeah, they're going to college, yeah, so big whoopee, they're going to get a job. Oops, not in this economy.
Right.
And so what happens to those student loans? Well, you know what? Since 1995, so we're talking about 95, 2005, so
15 years?
In 15 years, 40% of the students who borrowed loans to attend for-profit institutions, that's the Stanfords and the Yales and all of those, 40% of those students defaulted since 1995 to the present date.
And you can expect that to accelerate for obvious reasons.
I mean, for-profits educate less than 10% of the students.
Right.
So if it's a 40% default rate since 1995, then what in the world is going on with those other 90% of the students?
Yes, and remember that the for-profits are generally the schools with more cachet, too, which makes it in some respects easier to get a job. At least a good paying job at some point. I'm not belittling state education or state school education because I have one myself at the Citadel. Despite it being a military school, it is a state college or state university.
Yes.
I got a very fine education there, and it's done me very well in my life. But right now, as people get out of school, they are finding that the doors are closed or that there's intense competition for the jobs, and the old law of supply and demand cannot be repealed no matter how many congressmen Obama has in his pocket.
Very good.
And, you know, when you have 10 guys applying for a job, the company says, well, we were going to give $40,000 to start. We got two or three guys here to start for $25,000.
Yeah, exactly.
Just
enough to rent a place and have a little gas money to get to work.
That's exactly it.
That's right.
Incidentally, for those of you who are younger or on your way through school or getting ready to go to school or parents of the same, the industries to look forward to in the future, oddly enough, are going to be government jobs such as teaching, police and fire, and, of course, the ever-popular healthcare field. So.
Yeah,
those should be fairly good jobs for reasonably foreseeable future. So if you're struggling with what to do, consider getting a nursing degree. There are shortages of nurses almost everywhere I turn.
Everywhere,
And, of course, if you're of a higher mind and a little younger or whatever, I knew a guy who got his medical degree at the age of 50.
Really?
Please consider that. Or if you're a nurse... If you're a nurse, consider becoming a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant where you can get more money. These are going to become in greater need as we see doctors, and I know I'm veering off topic a little bit, but as we see doctors start to say, the heck with these government reimbursement rates for Medicare and Medicaid, I'm out.
Oh, yeah, so, absolutely.
So
absolutely.
There's a great, great potential for nurses or those who are thinking of the medical field and maybe not wanting to commit to a whole 15-year regimen that it takes to become a doctor, to become a physician's assistant.
Yep. The other thing that I would encourage people to at least think about is if you are contemplating a college education and you are contemplating going in the service, go into the ROTC program.
Yes, absolutely.
The government will pick up your college education. You're going to owe them some time at the end of that. But it is a way to get an education in a field that you like, have it paid for, and it's going to cost you some time. But you're going to be working in the field that you majored in, and that's a big plus. One other number I'm going to throw out, and then we can kind of move it on. At the end of 2009, end of the 2009 fiscal year, there was $50.8 billion worth of loans that were in default for student loans.
Right.
And that is another astounding number. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Well, we just nationalized student loans, too.
Well, yes, we did. You know, and it's going to be tougher to get them now. It really is. And we're also going to lose jobs because of that. I read a report here some months back. There were 2,300 jobs that were lost in the financial services field out of one firm that did student loans, and they didn't need them anymore. And so those folks hit the streets. And that's, again, another indication that, you know what, this job market isn't all that really swell great. If you have a marketable skill, good on you. I'm glad for you. I am certainly glad that I'm retired, and I don't have to mess with that. I got to mess with other things, but I don't have to mess with that part. So if we talk about a stock market that initially goes down to 6,500, we've got a credit. You know what we didn't touch on that credit crunch and credit bubble is the actual credit crunch that banks are no longer lending.
Oh yes, it's killing small business, because in order to get a loan from a bank now as a business, you have to pretty much be an investment-grade publicly traded company.
Yep.
Joe's pizza parlor is not getting another $200,000 to upgrade his kitchen equipment right now.
He sure isn't.
But Bill, even worse than that. And Bill, who just got out of the service, who wants to open a liquor store, is not getting the $1 million it's going to take to do that.
He isn't going to get that at all. But the other thing that happens is this, and that's, you know, kind of fits right into our theory that these bubbles are coinciding at a particularly bad time. The people that build things go through a lot of money, and they typically have operating lines of credit. They've got materials bills. They have got all kinds of credit that has to be available to them in order for them to continue to do what they do.
Absolutely, and small manufacturing along the same way.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Work in progress means you got dollars tied up, and it isn't ready for sale, but your dollars are tied up, and you can't
and
do that out of capital.
And
oh,
inventory
yeah.
loans for small
yep.
business, small retailers
accounts
who typically take a 90-day note to fund their inventory.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, you know, this just exacerbates what's happening in the job market, because
if you follow
the trail of how a job gets created, and the only system that I know of that does that well is capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a person that, let's say, is building houses. So he goes through the entire planning process and gets his subdivision somehow approved. But all he's got is bare dirt. He's got imaginary lines marked out. He's got roads marked out and all that kind of stuff, but it's bare dirt. He then has to go to a bank and get a loan. And maybe it's a couple of different loans. Now, Then he starts on the infrastructure. That's roads, sewer, water, telephone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all got to get in before he can build a house. So now we've got a lot of money that's going out there. Now, he's hiring people to do this. Okay, there's the ditch diggers, and there's the plumbing folks, and there's the electrical folks, and there's the pavers, and the concrete folks that do all the sidewalks and the curbs, until you've got this really nice bare piece of ground with infrastructure in it. He's hired some folks to do that before he's ever built one house.
Right, before he pours the first foundation.
Absolutely. So now he's got to start getting construction loans. This is over and above what he had to put out for infrastructure.
And
so he does that.
Cost of land.
Yes, yes. So now he gets his construction loans to actually start building these houses that he's really in the business of doing. And he's going to hire the plumbers and the electricians and the carpenters and the drywall guys and the roofers and all of those people. He's going to hire them out of this money so that they can build his houses. So if you short-circuit that at any point in that process, up to that time when he's got a construction loan to actually build houses with, you have simply shut down that entire industry. It's gone.
That's correct.
It's nowhere more to be seen. Now,
And don't forget the microeconomics in the community of the drywaller not being able to buy groceries, so the grocery
yep.
store guy takes a hit.
Yep.
And so forth. It just trickles through the entire economy. Think of everything you buy every day. Well, those people building houses do the same thing.
Absolutely. And you know, this is a really crying shame. The banks have got money. I mean, you know, you can look at their investment portfolios, and their investment portfolios are primarily with government guaranteed bonds and notes, treasury notes, and that kind of thing. You can look at their balance sheets and you can say, yeah, they've got money and they aren't lending it out. And when they do that, they shut down everybody from the corner grocery guy all the way up to the big house builders, all the way through the manufacturing jobs that we have very few left of. And we get into this. There's a concept called it's called, I think, the good cycle, where you...
Yeah, virtuous cycle.
Virtuous cycle. There you go. This
right.
is the opposite of the virtuous cycle.
Yeah, it's called a vicious circle.
And a death spiral.
Death spiral is another good word for it.
There
and
you go.
Backing up for just a moment, remember...
Yeah.
70% of all jobs in this country are created by small business. Now, of course, Obama would like to reverse that and make it 70% of all jobs created by government. But, of course, anybody with one working brain cell in their head can realize you cannot have more people in the wagon than pulling it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It just never works. Santana said those who do not either read or understand history or are bound to repeat it. And boy, you look at what we're doing, and two things spring to my mind. One, this is a really great parallel with 1929. You have touched on this before. The other thing that springs to mind is this. When we get into death spirals, we always look for the causes. At least I do. And it seems to me that whenever you look at a country and you look at their economic system, if it is based on Keynesian economics, if it is based on Marxism, communism, Leninism, if it is like the old Italy under Mussolini and is a corporatism, if you will,
Fascism, corporate fascism.
Yep, absolutely. What you see are failed economies.
Mm-hmm. Oh, history's littered with them.
Absolutely.
Over and over and over.
They'll work for a little while. For a little while you can make them work.
Mm-hmm.
But they will never, ever hit their potential. And the beauty of this country based on capitalism is we hit our potential. The more we drag that down, the more we regulate it, the more we tax it, the more we say, no, the government needs to do that, the further away from capitalism we get, and the quicker our economy goes in, the crapper. There's not a good way to say that one.
No.
We've got about 10 minutes left.
Where'd you go?
Maybe some of our listeners can. But I remember a couple of years ago, and I remember a couple of years ago pretty vividly because fuel got up to $4 and $5 a gallon, and I had to park my fifth wheel, and I'm not traveling because fuel costs are simply too high. And the reason for that was given at the time, well, one, the price of oil went way up. And yeah, it did. It hit about, what, $140 a barrel, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the other reasons were, well, that just jacks up the cost of fuel because we don't have that refinery right now. We've got to go fix it up and get it running again, and then we'll have fuel for you. So here's my question. We have this massive oil spill in the Gulf. We have the Bureau of Environmental Nazism telling the state of Texas that 33 of their refineries are going to have to apply for new clean air permits. We have oil that's at 70-something a barrel, and yet fuel is still only at $3 a gallon. Right here in my hometown of Hay Fork, California, it's $3.99 a gallon for diesel, a little less than that for regular. So my question here is this. If shutting down refineries and the price of oil is such a big, huge factor in the price of fuel, why haven't we seen fuel prices rise dramatically?
Well, simply because demand is lower. There are fewer people driving to work. There are fewer goods being moved. That's the only thing saving us right now from out-of-control fuel prices is that there simply isn't the demand for it at the moment. Now, should the supply drop further as, we're killing all the drilling in the Gulf. Obama's actions are akin to grounding every airplane because one crashed.
Yeah, right.
It's really rather idiotic. We're taking every car off the road because somebody hit a tree. But if they dry up this supply by moving, and the rigs are leaving, they're not going to be back for a long time, so you're going to know 35,000 people in the Gulf that are going to be out of work as a result of that.
Yeah.
Of course, all the lost tourism money. But if you take away that production capacity, you've pretty much got the government owning 60 or 70% of the land out west of Oklahoma, where it cannot be drilled on without special government permission. You shut down some refineries, and you push the price of oil up on the people at this point. Remember what the price of oil going up did. It led to the first start of the recession.
Yes, when
fuel prices got out of control. And people are scraping by the skin of their teeth right now. You probably would because you've been in the financial industry.
Yeah.
I get people DMing me all the time going, Greg, what do I do? I have nothing. What do I do to plan for the future? You're giving a lot of good advice, but it doesn't apply to me because I don't have anything.
Yep.
And that's where a lot of folks are right now, and they're in a real, rather desperate situation. And to make matters even worse, you brought up 1929.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Smoot-Hawley tariff was the final nail in the coffin of the American economy.
Yes, it was.
Well, 164 days from now, we're going to get our second version of the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which at that time was the largest tax increase in U.S. history.
Wow.
We are about to face that again. And in January, there will be a $1 trillion tax increase put upon the American people who have already been squeezed enough. Now, oh, good, it's going to hit the rich. No. Everyone who's married is seeing their taxes go up because the marriage penalty will come back.
Yep.
The bottom tax rate will go from 10 to 15%. So the poorest workers who have tax liability are going to get a 50% tax increase. You're going to see the child tax credit go from $1,000 to $500 a child again. Mm-hmm. So that's going to affect every family with children.
Yep.
So don't tell me this is only going to affect the rich. And on top of that, why would we want to affect the rich? The last time I looked, I didn't see any poor people hiring anyone to work on their house or mow their grass.
I've never had a poor person write me out a paycheck, ever.
That's exactly right.
It just doesn't happen.
And on top of that, the rich are fleeing the country in record numbers. They're going to Costa Rica. We've already seen many of them flee from New York and New Jersey to Florida. The next stop is Costa Rica, where they only have a 25% top marginal tax rate. They're going to do what Jobs did when we had the highest corporate tax rate in the world. They're going to go overseas. And our wealthy are going to go, and they're going to take their tax money with them, and that's going to further dry up revenues. Plus, we cannot discount the Laffer curve, which says simply that there's a certain point at which when government takes another tax increase, they actually get diminishing returns because they kill the activity they're taxing.
Yeah.
So the government is actually going to see, they're not going to see a $1 trillion increase. They're actually going to see less in the long run because of this action.
Absolutely. And, you know, it seems to me that's the lesson that they never learn. There you go. I don't know. One of the things that happened in the 1929 Depression was that people's outlooks changed dramatically.
From the roaring 20s.
They became risk-averse. They became debt-averse.
Mm-hmm.
They became much more self-reliant. They grew their own vegetables. And all of those things that say, you know what, times are tough, but I can survive this. And I think that we're in another period like that. I mean, I know that from my, I don't know, probably 30s, somewhere along in there, it's been a me culture. It's been, I want this, I'm going to go get it. I don't have to do that. I can pay somebody to do that. It's been all of these things combined that said, and I didn't live beyond my means, but it was convenient.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people are going to wake up to, we can no longer afford convenient. We can no longer afford to not supply what we can for ourselves, because people's attitudes are going to shift over this. They're going to become self-reliant. They are going to become very much more risk-averse. They're going to become very much more debt-averse.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your take on it?
Yes, I see that. I mean, you talk to people who grew up in the Depression. They don't have credit cards. They consider them to be from the devil. About the only debt they ever had in their life was a car loan and a house. And many of them paid cash for their cars most of their life. It just was a different culture. And I think in a way that this will serve us well. I think I'm not going to get too philosophical, but I do believe God is in control at all times. And I do believe that this is going to be for our own good in the long run, that people will learn once again the value of a dollar. They will they will not go out and buy a bottle of water for a dollar anymore. That's just the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
And a latte a day keeps retirement away. These $5 lattes, that's a very common phrase in the financial planning industry. Drop your $5 latte and I can help you retire.
Exactly.
So I think people are going to actually learn how to, you know, put leftovers in the refrigerator instead of down the disposal. People are going to learn how to get 5 to 10 years out of a car instead of trading it in on every model cycle on a bad lease.
Exactly.
People are going to learn how to help each other as a result of this, and that may be the best part of this. And they're going to stop looking to the government to be the end-all, be-all when, you know, Ronald Reagan said it very well, government is not the solution, government is the problem.
It certainly is. Greg, thank you so much for being on. I appreciate it. One of these days we're going to have to do a whole segment on the Depression and what the parallels are and all that kind of thing. But
be
for
glad
now,
to come back anytime you want.
We're down. Thank you so much, Greg. I appreciate it.
All right.
Bye now.